So we should get started. So as I said, normally it looks like probably some of our people are lost in the streets of Parramatta somewhere. That's what I assume. Anyway, they probably will come in over time. Let's see. Meanwhile, we can do some Pali chanting. Do we have the chanting sheets? Ishika has them, and she's probably one of the lost souls, I assume. So we're going to be doing some chanting in Pali in a minute. And we would love to share our chanting sheets with you all, but oh well. Next time. Okay. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang saranang gacchami, Dhammang saranang Dutiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami. Atiyampi saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Anuttaro purisa dhammasāraṭhi. Sattha deva manussanam buddho bhagavati. Svākhāto bhagavata dhammo sandhittiko akāliko ehipāsiko opanayiko Pacatang veditabbo vinyuhiti. Supatipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho. Ujupatipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho. Nyahayapatipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho. Samichipatipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho. Yadidam chattari purisa yugani Anuttaram punyakhetam lokasati. Okay, very good. Okay, so after the chanting, I usually say a few words about meditation. And then we do some guided meditation together. I'm just wondering, we can't switch some of the lights off, can we? Oh, that would be nice to have a little bit of mood lighting for the meditation. D means. Ah, no, that's the thing. Okay, so the winyuhi, the T is that. T means quotes.
I think it will be like everything. Yeah.
So it doesn't change the meaning of it, but it just means it's a quote from something. Yeah. Yeah. You put T at the end of it when you want to say quote marks in English. Yeah. Which can be a problem because you only mark the end of it. You don't necessarily know where the beginning is. Sometimes it's not clear. Okay. We're good? All right. No problems. Okay, so when we think of Buddhism and we think of the Buddha, the first thing that comes to mind is the image of a man sitting peacefully in meditation. And as far as Buddhism goes, our ideal practice is to emulate the path of the Buddha himself. The Buddha practiced for many years and learned and developed meditation, studied under different teachers. But ultimately, he had to find his own way. And so according to the accounts that are passed down in the Buddhist scriptures, he sat down under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya, near the Naranjara River. And in those days, there was a little town there called Uruvela. And sat down there to meditate. So whenever we meditate, we are emulating the practice of the Buddha. So the path of meditation is very simple and yet also very subtle. When we meditate, we are not invoking or calling upon any gods. We are not trying to gain any kind of powers or anything like that. We are not trying to make our mind be anything that it isn't. And we're not trying to shape our mind into something that it's not. The purpose of meditation is to let go. It sounds like obvious, maybe. It sounds too simple, maybe. But that's the essence of it. So all of the schools of meditation, all of the techniques, all of the different teachers, all of these are there simply to support us to be able to let go. To let go of what? To let go of craving, to let go of attachments, to let go of hatred, to let go of bigotry. And why do we let go of these things? We let go of these things because these things create suffering. They create suffering for ourselves and they create suffering for others. And we can ask ourselves, is there a kind of hate that is okay? Is there a kind of anger that's justified? And if you look closely, you'll find that anger is always... it always creates some kind of suffering, no matter how justified you might think you are. And the same thing with greed. We might think that we have, like, our greed is under control and everything is okay and everything's worked out, and yet somehow it will always create suffering in the end. This is nothing personal. It's nothing to do with us, with who we are. It's just how things are. Nothing we can do about it. So the Buddha taught us a path to be able to let go. Now, meditation is one of the crucial dimensions of that path. Now, we can practice meditation many different ways, and all of those different ways are fine. If you have a way of practicing meditation, then great, keep doing it. So I never would tell anybody to stop doing the meditation that they're doing or anything like that. Only if they've kind of reached some dead end or if they have some problem with the meditation. But normally, if you're doing a practice and you're happy with that practice, then you just keep doing it. There's no sense in switching from one practice to another. Okay. But the most common practice we do in Buddhism is practice of mindfulness of breathing. And in a few minutes, we'll do some guided mindfulness of breathing meditation together. So let me just say a few words about this practice before we start. So this is the practice that the Buddha developed when he was sitting under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya, and he developed on the night of his enlightenment. And it's a practice that he continued to practice through his life. In fact, when he would go away on retreat, and when he went away, and when he told the monks that he was going to go on retreat, then he would say to them, "If anybody asks you what I'm doing on retreat, tell them that I'm watching my breath come in and out." And that's the practice of mindfulness of breathing. Now, when people come to the practice of mindfulness of breathing, there is one mistake that many people make, and that is that people try to concentrate. They try to focus. They try to make themselves pay attention to their breath. And when you do that, you'll find that the breath gets very slippery, and the mind gets very tense, and that everything seems like it's hard work. So that's not how to do meditation. Meditation, like I said, is about letting go. Right? About letting go. Think about it. Think about your breath. What is your breath doing right now? Well, your breath is keeping you alive. Your breath is reminding you that you are here. Your breath has been with you your whole life, every moment, bringing life in and sustaining you. Yeah. Your breath is taking care of you. Yeah. It has always been taking care of you. And until the day that you die, it will take care of you. So it's not up to us to try to, we don't have to worry about our breath. The breath is worrying about us. The breath is taking care of us. So when we meditate, just let the breath take care of us. Let the breath come and calm you down. Let it soothe you. The breath wants to take all of your troubles and stresses and anxieties away. So just let it step out of the way and let your breath take care of you. And if you can do that, it takes trust to do that. If you don't trust, you always want to control. That's why we want to control. We're afraid. We think something bad is going to happen. We have to learn to trust. Sorry, somebody's online. Can we have can someone who knows what they're doing mute? Great, thanks, Michael. Great. If we have that faith and if we have that trust in our breath, then we can learn to let the breath take care of us, and we can learn to let ourselves be given over to the path of peace. And the path of peace is something that unfolds naturally. It's not something that we have to make. It's not something we have to create. It's something that carries us along like a surging river. So all we have to do is let go and trust, and our breath will take care of us. Let's do some meditation for about 20 minutes or so. What do you think? Should we turn the lights off or should we keep them on, or what do you think?
It was quite nice with just the fairy lights. Yeah.
Okay, we can just have the fairy lights, okay? So I look like I have a halo above my head now, just to let people online know that's just the lighting effects. So sitting quietly, letting the mind settle back into the body, and allowing the body to relax, allowing the mind to relax, and just taking a couple of minutes to be present. And then bringing attention to the gentle feeling of the breath as it comes in and the breath as it goes out. Mindfully breathing in and mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in and mindfully breathing out. When your mind is wandering off, scattering, thinking about this and that, don't worry about it too much. Just be aware. Ah, okay. Coming back, being present, and letting the breath calm you down. Mindfully breathing in. Mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in and mindfully breathing out. mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. So now coming near to the end of the meditation, I want you to let your awareness go back into your senses, into your body, into how your present moment feels right now. And I want you to just take a minute to come back to normal, and then reflect back over the course of the meditation, inquiring into cause and effect. What has been changing? What has been staying the same? What's the mind like now? What kinds of things were distracting you? What kinds of things were helping you? What did the breath feel like? So each time you meditate, you can ask yourself these questions, reflect like this for a few minutes at the end of the meditation. When you do that, it helps you to learn and to understand and to grow. And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, very good. So let's just have a break at this point, and we'll have a break for like 5 minutes or so, and you want to... Thank you. You want to grab a cup of tea or just introduce yourself, have a bit of a chat, then please feel free, and we'll come back for some Dhamma talk in a few minutes. Bhumi, do we have a bell?
Yes.
Can someone ring the bell for us? No, we don't have to use YouTube for our bell. You can ring. Is it working?
Yeah.
It needs batteries. Right. Normally I just put it on YouTube and we get a bell off YouTube. So it's much better. Okay. So welcome back everybody, and hopefully we're settling down and getting ready for the thing. Now I just want to give a short apology to, especially for those new friends who've joined us here with the Temple of Humanity, because we're actually in the middle of a course, which is, I promised everybody, would be a very difficult and technical description of the most difficult of the Buddha's teachings, okay? So you're now plunging into the middle of that, okay? So if you don't understand anything, you're not alone, okay? So just we'll see how we go, and we will find something. All right, so... This is the fourth week that we've been talking about dependent origination, and I wanted to continue to talk about that for the rest of this rains retreat and to try to explore it from different angles and different perspectives as best we can. So in the first week, we did an introduction. The second week, we looked at it in terms of the as it relates to like myths and stories about creation. Last week we went into the terminology, and we looked at how the words and the terms of dependent origination reflect the themes and the ideas that the Buddha was trying to get at through this teaching. And in all of this, we are trying to bear in mind the overall purpose of dependent origination, of course, is a philosophy, and is a description and analysis of the world, how the world is, how our own experience is. But it's not just intended as an abstract philosophy. It's intended as a practical philosophy. It's intended to be something that helps us to understand how it is that we get entrapped, how it is that we get caught up in suffering, even though we want to be free. We all want, that's the, our deepest yearning is to be free of suffering, to be happy. And yet somehow we find ourselves caught and trapped in that from the beginning. And the Buddha traced in standard dependent origination a series of 12 links, which begin with ignorance. Then because of ignorance, we make choices. Our choices condition how our consciousness is. Consciousness conditions how our name and form, that is, how our individual manifestation of our body and mind are. And through that, then we experience things through our six senses, and the six senses, then we experience contact, that is the coming together of the internal and external. And in response to that contact, we experience a feeling. So we like something or we don't like it. And then when we have that feeling, we then have a craving. And then when that craving then settles in and we reflect on it, so on, it becomes like a grasping and attachment, then that creates, as it were, a new existence, a new life, a new being. And that new being manifests through rebirth into old age, sickness and death, and so on. And so these are the 12 links of dependent origination. And that's the bad news. The good news is that because this all begins with ignorance, then if we have understanding, then we can let go and we can find that freedom. And so the path of dependent origination is through understanding how that process of suffering is created and in learning how to let go. So for this week, I wanted to look at the grammar of dependent origination. So this is going to be like, if you thought that the last couple of weeks, right, were just sort of too general and not technical enough, then this week we're going to really hone in, all right? So when we think about language, language typically has talks about things and talks about those things in relationship to each other. So you talked about the words, the things that dependent origination, the entities, the actual phenomena that dependent origination is concerned with. And now we're talking about how the Buddha talked about the relationships between those things. Now, when we talk about those relationships, we talk about causality. We talk about conditionality. We talk about this is creating that. And there are so many different ways we can express this linguistically. In English, of course, we have our own ways of doing this, which brings together a set of assumptions and has a set of connotations to it. For example, if in English we were to talk about, let's say, creation, then that has a kind of biblical connotation to it, whether we intend that or not, but creation is closely associated with Christianity and with Genesis. So it kinds of has that kind of feeling to it. And so words have these connotations and these flavors. And the Buddha, one of the things that I've learned through many years of studying and practicing Buddhism and of looking at how the Buddha's words are chosen, is that I found that the Buddha's words are chosen very carefully. And the manner in which he expressed himself is very subtle. And there's many occasions where he would express himself in a way that that avoids creating a whole range of different kinds of problems. And that a lot of people who come like afterwards, maybe different commentators and so on and so forth, perhaps aren't so subtle in the way that they express it, and then fall into different problems of interpretation, different implications and connotations, which when you trace it back and look at what the Buddha himself said, don't really apply to what the Buddha himself said. And we may see some examples of this during this course, perhaps even today. So I want to have a look at the manner in which the Buddha expressed himself and to ask whether that has any implications, both in terms of the things that are said as well as the things that are not said. All right. And to do this, we're going to begin by looking at the what we can describe as the abstract principle of dependent origination. All right. Now, I think I mentioned last week I've been doing some annotations for this section on dependent origination, and they're now published, so you can find them online. And for this week, I'm going to be sharing with you one particular sutta. I'm going to be popping that into the chat there if you want to look at that. And this is SN 12.37, Sanyutta Nikaya 12.37. And I just want to preface this by saying I don't think I'm going to be talking about the sutta as a whole. I'm just talking about the passage on the abstract principle of dependent origination, which occurs a number of times in the suttas. It just happens to be this time, which is where I've made the notes on it. So we're not going to go through the whole sutta, I don't think. We're just going to be focusing on that one little bit. We might come back to the sutta later on. All right, so a couple of in the paragraphs down in that sutta, we have the phrase, when this exists, this comes to be. Due to the arising of this, this arises. When this doesn't exist, this doesn't come to be. Due to the cessation of this, this ceases. Okay, so this is what I'm calling the abstract principle of dependent origination, or perhaps the abstract formula or the general formula for dependent origination. So first of all, just a quick sidebar is that sometimes in modern days, sometimes we find that this this summary is called idapachayata, the specific conditionality, and the sequence of 12 links is called paticca-samuppada, dependent origination. So that's a distinction which we find certain modern textbooks in Theravada will make, but that distinction doesn't apply in the suttas. So I'm just mentioning that, by the way, just so we don't get confused and we don't trip over ourselves by mistaking what these words mean. Those two words are used in the suttas for both of those things, right? Idapachayata, specific conditionality, and paticca-samuppada, dependent origination, describe both the general formula as well as the set of 12 links. Okay. Please. Thank you so much. Okay, so let's have a bit of a look a little bit more closely and take a little bit of time with this set of links, because this tells us, I think, something about the manner in which the Buddha expresses himself and chose to express this very subtle teaching. Okay, first of all, notice that that teaching has four phrases. When this being, that is, due to the arising of this, that arises. This being, this is not. When this, due to the cessation of this, this ceases. Okay, so we have four phrases. Okay, are we with me so far? Okay, good. And those four phrases are divided into two, right? So we have the origination, a pair of phrases for origination, and a pair of phrases for the cessation. Also with me? Okay, fine. So that number, so we have basically the number four, right? So the number four is very significant in Buddhism. There are lots of fours in Buddhism. We have, what do we have? We have the four, we have the Four Noble Truths. Thank you so much. Yes, Four Noble Truths. And we have what else? We have the four directions, right? We have the fourfold parisa, the fourfold assembly of the Buddha's dispensation. We have so many fours. There's a whole big book of fours, bigger than any of the other books on any of the other numbers, okay? So four has a general sense of something which is universal and inclusive, all right, and balanced, right? So the number four is universal, inclusive, and balanced. That's the general idea with the number four. And in that way, the kind of the two times two, in a way, it's a bit like the two, you know, the legs of an animal, right? Yeah, the two by two. That's kind of balanced and it's strong, yeah? Okay. So there's kind of a geometry to it. And I'm just mentioning this because much of like what we see when we see the Buddha's teachings, it, and especially in the suttas, it conveys this sense of authority and completion and almost perfection through the choices of these very, very, very symmetrical and balanced ways of expressing itself. And so these are things that we don't normally notice when we're reading it or we're looking at the teaching, but it somehow conveys that sense to us. It's an aesthetic choice that conveys a certain dimension of the Buddha's teachings. Okay. So imasmin sati idang hoti. This being this is, imasupada idang upajati, this arises, imasming asati idang nahoti, this not being, this is not, imasa nirodha idang nirujati, the four statements. So I'm going to take the origination statements to begin with, and I'm going to take the first one of those origination statements, so the first out of the four. Imasming sati idang hoti. So just checking, do we have any Pali nerds with us today? No? Any Pali nerds? Dhiriyupa, how are you going? How's your Pali going? Have you reached the locative absolute yet? Anyone? No? So Dhiriyupa's reached the locative absolute. So please give us a quick definition of the locative absolute. So the locative absolute is in fact the same construction in Pali as it is in the English translation. So we can actually mirror this particular construction quite well in English, this being that is. All right. So what an absolute construction does is that in a sense it makes a statement which is separated, that's what the absolute means, it's separated from the main grammar of the sentence, from the main logic. So it's an absolute statement, and in this case it's expressing conditionality. So it's saying when there is the presence of this thing, right, then this thing happens. Yeah, that's the kind of statement that it's making. But what's important to notice is that it doesn't tell us anything about the time relationship between them, right? It doesn't say this happens and then that happens, okay? With me? Yeah? So this is kind of interesting, isn't it, right? Because normally you think with causality, that causality one happens after the other, right? It rains on the mountaintop and then the water gathers in the puddles and then the puddles gather in the creeks and then the creeks flow into the rivers and then the rivers flow into the ocean. And, of course, the Buddha expressed himself like that many times. But in this particular case, he's avoiding that way of expressing itself, right? Remember what I said before about the Buddha choosing to express himself very carefully so as to not get himself involved in implications that are going to create a trouble later on, okay? So the Buddha is avoiding making any temporal assumptions here. This being so, that is, rather than talking in terms of time, we're talking in terms of presence, okay? It's the presence of this thing, then there is the presence of this thing, okay? We're all on the same page here? Understand? So this is one of the ways in which the Buddha talked about conditionality. Let's look at the second phrase. Second phrase, imasupada idang upajati. So here the verb is upajati, to arise. In the previous one, I should have mentioned the verb is sati, to be or to exist. And in this one, the verb is upajati, to arise. Right? No, this is another sati.
To make it more complicated.
Yes, this is another one. Yes, so sati means mindfulness. That's smriti in Sanskrit. This is another sati. It's asti in Sanskrit or atti in Pali. Yeah. Very confusing, isn't it? It could be even more confusing because that's one to be also in some cases is santi, which is also peace. Yeah, that's another word. So this is why confusion happens. Anyway, so the second half, okay? Imasupada idang upajati. So this is using now a different grammatical construction. All right. This is now using. Anybody want to take a stab at what grammatical construction we got here? Dhiriyupa, imasupada So this is an ablative, okay? You know ablatives, right? So an ablative expresses the general sense of from, okay? Most of the time expresses the sense of from. Something goes, if I was to do something like, let's say, go out from the village, I would say gama gachami, I go from the village, okay? So that is a normal sense. And in this case, obviously, it's another way of expressing cause, right? So this is coming from that, okay? So rather than emphasizing presence, yeah, the first side was emphasizing in the presence of this is. Now we're emphasizing derivation. From this is. Yeah? Two different ways of talking about cause, okay? So it's not that they necessarily have a different meaning, but that they have a slightly different connotation, a slightly different, they're talking about causality from slightly different dimensions, okay? And the verb, of course, is different as well. So the verb sati in the first one, or ati, means to be, to exist, and then this one means to arise, yeah? So from the arising of this arises. Now, this is not specifying any particular point in time, okay? This is not saying that when this finishes, then that happens, okay? It's not saying this is like a sequence like that, but it does express derivation. Something's coming from something else, all right? And the verb upajati expresses a more kind of dynamic sense, to arise rather than to be, okay? Still with me? All right. Now then, in the negative form, of course, we have the opposite of all those things. The same two constructions, but the opposite construction. You must mean asati, this not being, that is not. When this, due to the cessation of this ceases. All right. So those same two constructions, the locative absolute construction and the ablative construction, both in a pair expressing the notion of dependent origination. All right. So, now, a few details worth pointing out here. Now, when we translate this, usually you find people translate, and in fact, I also translated it until recently, as this being so, that is. Okay? This arising, that arises. Right? This and that. Yeah? But the Pali doesn't have this and that. In the Pali, everything is this, which I thought was quite interesting. And to be clear, Pali is quite capable of differentiating this and that. It has different pronoun forms, and so you can say this and that in Pali, just like you can in English. But it doesn't. It specifically says this arising from when due to the arising of this arises. When this is. Kind of interesting, right? Maybe it doesn't mean anything, yeah? Maybe it doesn't mean anything, but maybe it does. So this kind of construction in Pali is characteristically used when it's expressing a strong identity, right? So the normal construction in Pali would be something like this. Let's take a philosophical statement, okay? In Pali, a normal way of saying, for example, that let's say that the soul is the same as the body, all right? So you would say, yo jivang tang sarirang, something like that. Yang jivang tang sarirang, all right? Yang jivang tang sarirang would mean that which is the self, that which is the soul, is the same as the body, all right? So this is the normal way you do this in Pali. It's called a relative and demonstrative pronouns. But in this particular construction, you're using two demonstrative pronouns, not that which is the body, that which is the soul is the body, but you're saying that which is the body, that which is the soul. Tang jivang, tang sarirang. This is what they use in that case. It's asserting an emphatic identity. In other words, you're saying the soul is absolutely identical in every way with the body. Okay? We clear? Right? It's a characteristic grammatical idiom that asserts an absolute identity. But here the Buddha is, I believe, the Buddha is choosing that to subvert that meaning. That thing which we look at and which seems to be the same is in fact changing in that process of dependent origination. this is what I think is going, because the suttas end in the text, they also use a similar construction to say imasa anyadeva upajati idang anyang nirujati, that which arises as one thing and ceases as another. So this is, I think, the implication here, that there's a subversion of this idea that these things can be absolutely identical. Simran, were you going to ask a question? No, you sure?
Sorry, I'm just itchy.
You're just itchy. Oh, okay. Fine. Okay, so Anwei says the same thing in Chinese, that they translate in Chinese as this and that as well. Yeah, so that's kind of interesting, isn't it? So it's a choice. I'm not saying it's a wrong choice in translation. I'm just saying that the implication of that is not in Pali. The Pali is this and this. And it could have said this and that, but it didn't. It's a subtle difference. Maybe too subtle. Maybe it doesn't mean anything, but I think it does. Okay. So so far we've looked at the fourfold statement of dependent origination. We've looked at the locative absolute construction, and we've looked at the ablative construction. We've discussed about how these are two pairs, right? So they complement each other. So I think these are like expressing two complementary dimensions of causality. One of them emphasizing that the presence of something is required for the presence of something else, and the other is emphasizing the derivation of one thing from another. Right? Now, when we look at the Scott has his comment here: not too subtle. Long live the nuance. Thank you, Scott. Thank you. I'm glad that somebody else appreciates these things too. Okay, so when we look at how dependent origination is expressed in the full 12-fold sequence, we find both of these forms used. Sometimes one, sometimes the other, sometimes both. And I'm just going to quickly look. I actually note that in the note on our SN 12.37, but I'll just quickly look at a couple of examples of each of these. So in, where are we now? In, sorry, I opened up too many links. Okay, so in SN 12.49, I'll put the link there for folks online. We find the locative absolute construction. That's right, 12.49. So let me just read that out. So this actually quotes that general formula. When this exists, this comes to be. Due to the arising of this, this arises. And then it goes on. When ignorance exists, choices come to be. When choices exist, consciousness comes to be. When consciousness exists, name and form come to be. When name and form exist, the six senses come to be. When the six senses exist, contact comes to be. When contact exists, feeling comes to be. When feeling exists, craving comes to be. When craving exists, grasping comes to be. When grasping exists, continued existence comes to be. When continued existence exists, rebirth comes to be. When rebirth exists, old age and death come to be. And they understand that is how the world originates. So you can see that this is just using, it's applying that same general principle, using exactly the same grammatical construction, and it's applying it to every one of the links in dependent origination. Okay. Now, we also find the second part, the ablative construction used. In fact, the ablative construction is the normal way that dependent origination is presented. Right? So the normal sequence of dependent origination, literally we would translate that as due to avijja paccaya sankhara would be due to the dependency of ignorance, there is choices. Due to the dependency of choices, there is consciousness. Due to the dependency of consciousness, there is name and form, and so on. Now, that's a bit of a clumsy way of expressing it in English, so we usually find a slightly more idiomatic way to express it. And at the moment, I'm expressing it ignorance is a requirement for choices. Choices are a requirement for consciousness. Consciousness is a requirement for name and form, and so on. But there are a few couple of things which are interesting about the standard formula. So now we're at the standard formula, right? Avijja paccaya sankhara. So again, Dira Yupa, I'm giving you a hard time here. Now, when we say avijja paccaya sankhara, can you identify where is the verb? No. So Diriyupa is now giving up in despair and thinking, why did I ever try to even think about trying to learn Pali? Right? Trick question. There is no verb. There's no verb. No. Okay? There's no verb. That's weird, isn't it? Avijja paccaya sankhara, there's no word. It's literally ignorance, condition, choices. Choices, condition, consciousness. Consciousness, that's it. There's no verbs. Now, this isn't that unusual in Pali. So Pali, you can leave the verbs, especially the verb is, implicit. And that's what's happening here. Hello, whoever's coming out over the microphone. Lovely to hear your happy, laughing voice. Okay. Somebody's happy. That's really nice. Can we mute them now? We've learned that they're thanks. Okay, very good. Thank you for sharing your joy with us. Okay. So so in Pali, you can leave the verbs implicit. You don't have to actually state what the verbs are. Now, this is there's an argument to be made here, okay, which is going to get too technical for this class, which you know, consider that, okay? So I'm going to leave that aside, okay? And I know you're all grateful for that. But in fact, it seems to be misinterpreted by the commentary. I won't go into all of that kind of detail. But what you can see is that the general principle of dependent origination actually supplies the verbs which are implicit in the normal formula, right? It has the verb upajati, it arises. Yeah? So we know that this is actually what it means. It means that this is something that arises and that that verb, which is similar to the verb hoti, so the verb hoti to be or bhavati to be means to arise or to come to be and so on, and upajati to arise also has a similar meaning. So the verbs in, so we know that the verbs in the main 12-factored sequence are left implicit deliberately and that they are then supplied in the general formula. Right? This is kind of interesting. This is kind of nice. One of the things that this is doing is it's giving us like a compression. If any of you are like tech people, then you will know that this is how compression works, right? Rather than repeating the same thing the whole time, you can repeat it and you can create the main formula of dependent origination in a highly compressed form. And then you're giving the instructions on how that's to be expanded through the abstract principle. All right, a bit like a JPEG, yes, but without all of those blocky artifacts, right? So it's nice. And again, this comes back to that aesthetic sensibility with the Buddha's teaching. You see, there's something about dependent origination which is very mysterious, and I'm here unpacking all of these little technical details. But it's curious how a sequence of 12 terms with a simple relationship between them should have so much depth. We can find, you know, so many dozens and dozens and dozens of discourses on this. And in the later treatises, the Visuddhi Magga, then there's I don't know, 100 or a couple of hundred pages, probably like 100 pages or something, talking about dependent origination. And in all of the great treatises in Nagarjuna and Vasubandhu and Asanga, and so many people have written so much about dependent origination and so much depth within a simple list of those links. And there are so many patterns that unfold in here. And remember, I talked about how we have that fourfold grouping, right? Right. So you have the two arising and two ceasing, and that creates a fourfold pattern. Of course, dependent origination itself is 12. 12 is 3 times 4. 3 times 4 is the past, present, and future, you see? So if you have those 4 and then extend it to the past, present, and future, you have 12, right? So there are all of these patterns which are like enfolded into dependent origination, which compact the meaning of it in highly specific ways. And I believe that all of these things are intentional. Like I believe that the Buddha designed this teaching specifically for this reason. And in the different texts in the Sanyutta Nikaya, the Buddha gives different variations and unpacks dependent origination in different kinds of ways that will illustrate that. And we're going to be looking at some of those in the subsequent weeks. But for today, I wanted to just bring up one or two further things about the grammar and the way that the Buddha talked about dependency. Okay. So when we talk about dependent origination, the word I'm translating as dependent is paticca. And paticca is formed from the root I. So in Pali we have a root I, it's just the letter I. It's very cute. Okay? It means to go. It's a very cute little word. And it's a kind of funny root. Most roots are usually a bit longer than just one letter. But it's kind of funny one because when your root is just one letter, then it gets lost very easily. So here, that root it has almost been completely lost. Like you look at paticca, it doesn't really sound like to go or something like that. But in fact, it's an absolutive form, means having gone. And the pati here is a prefix meaning having gone back to. Literally means having gone back to. All right. And when we do the formula, so that's the word paticca samuppada. That's what paticca means. In the formula of dependent origination, avijja paccaya sankhara, we have the word paccaya. Okay. Paticca and paccaya. Two different words, right? Actually, it's the same word. All right. Paccaya is just a noun form. Paticca is the absolutive form. It's actually the same form, same word. Okay. So this is how these things go. And so again, having that sense of going back to. So I had a look at the pre-Buddhist texts, like the Brahmanas and Upanishads and so on, to see how these words are used in those contexts. And I don't know if I have any particular contexts right away. Did I notice any examples of that? I'm not sure if I have there. But it's basically used in that literal sense of to go back to something. To return to something. So maybe you've got lost and you're returning home or something like that. I don't know if I have an example to hand of that. Anyway, so one of the things that means is that if you think, again, if we think about dependent origination, right, you can, how do I put this? The stress in dependent origination is on leaning back to the thing that has caused something, right? Which is, it's kind of conveyed through the English word dependent. That's why we use dependent on, right? So if something is dependent on something, rather than, then you're emphasizing this side, rather than saying this causes that, right? You can see that slight difference. If I say this causes that, I'm emphasizing the first thing as being the active thing, which is driving that one. Yeah. I'm saying, no, this is dependent on that. Yeah? So it's almost like it's kind of leaning back on that thing which is coming out of the past. And again, the Buddha expressed himself in different ways. In some cases, he did use that active sense. There's one sutta where the Buddha talks about when ignorance surges, like a river would surge. In ignorance surges, choices surge. When choices surge, consciousness surges. When consciousness surges, name and form surge. So in that one, yes, it's like a rushing river which is driving you along, right? So I'm not saying that this is like a different meaning or contradictory meaning. I'm just saying that the characteristic way the Buddha wanted to express himself was to say something is like leaning back to it. And you kind of think about that, it's kind of interesting because it invites us because when we keep leaning back through that process, right, it invites us to lean back to ignorance, right? There's a darkness at the heart of all of this, and that darkness of ignorance is literally a no thing. It's not, the ignorance itself is not a thing. It's an absence of knowledge, right? So we can distinguish between ignorance and delusion. In generally, they're very similar in meaning, but ignorance is kind of an absence of knowing. It's a darkness, whereas delusion or moha is a twisting of knowledge, distortion of knowledge, right? So moha is something which is present and which actively works to distort reality. Yeah, this is delusion. It's making things seem other than what they really are, right? And ignorance is more just it's just dark. There's a vacuum. And in a way, it's kind of interesting and kind of a bit disturbing if we think about it like that. Like that our life and everything in our life is leaning back to, yeah? And then what is leaning back to? Leaning back to that ignorance. Of course, also true to say that ignorance itself is not without a cause, okay? So ignorance is not supposed to be an absolute. Everything is always proceeding in cycles of arising and ceasing. So ignorance itself has a cause, and that's discussed in the suttas as well. I'm not going to get into that just yet today. So this is some of the so for today, I've talked a bit about the grammar of dependent origination, and I've talked a bit about how the linguistic choices that the Buddha uses have implications in terms of both philosophical implications, but also, like, I guess, stylistic and aesthetic implications in terms of, like, how they are shaping the way that we pay attention to what the Buddha is talking about and how they convey that sense of balance and harmony and coherence through what the Buddha was saying. Now, one of the things that I have said a number of times, and somewhat provocatively, is that the Buddha never talked actually about causes. There's a whole kind of thing here, okay? When we talk about causes, okay, this was something that was critiqued by Nagarjuna in his very famous treatise, Mulamadhyamaka Karika. And he basically said that, like, I'm going to very loosely paraphrase Nagarjuna here, but basically says that when you look and try to see what kind of thing that a cause is, you can't really see that it's any kind of thing. Right? Right? And everybody's looking at me like I'm crazy. Well, and if we try to observe causing of things, we can never quite see the cause. You can see this happening and that happening, but you can't actually see this causing that. And the example I usually give up here, I've got my cup, and here I've got a bottle. Okay, now I'm going to move my bottle along here. I'm going to hit the cup, and when I hit that cup, you can hear a sound. You hear a sound? Yeah. So the movement of the bottle is causing that sound, right? Makes sense? Can you see that being caused? Can you see this causing that? I mean, after all, I mean, okay, many of you I've known for quite some years, and you know that I'm very sneaky. I could have recorded this beforehand, okay, and just be secretly playing it behind the scenes, and this is not actually happening at all, right? I mean, that it is, okay, but that kind of thing happens all the time. Like, we're constantly seeing things and then taking it to be something else. Right? It's extremely hard to identify what the cause of something is. And we can never actually see the cause. This was an argument that was made in Western philosophy by the philosopher David Hume many years ago. And David Hume is a very interesting philosopher. There is some speculation that he was one of the first philosophers who encountered Buddhist ideas. He stayed in a monastery in France where there was a French missionary who had been to Tibet. and had studied Buddhism there. So it's possible that he had encountered, or, you know, had a conversation and encountered some of these Buddhist ideas there. But regardless, he talked a lot about impermanence, and he talked a lot about how our sense of self and identity is always dissolving. And if you read, many of the things that he said actually sounds quite Buddhist. But one of the things that he said is that there's no such thing as cause. He said the idea of cause is purely a metaphysical assumption. That is to say, it's a way that we talk about things, but it doesn't actually exist. There's no such thing as a cause that exists in the world. It's not real. Yeah. It's kind of challenging when we think about this. Yeah. And it's kind of challenging if you're a scientist, right? It's very much inherent to science is the idea that things cause other things. And if you don't believe in causes, then a cause and a correlation are really not different. Right? So normally we say causation and correlation are different, right? Two things happen to become together at the same time. But if there's no such thing as a cause, then what we call a cause is merely a correlation for which we have not yet found an exception. Yes, can I?
Inform my brain.
Yes.
What correlation is it?
Correlation, when one thing happens and another thing happens. So, for example, in Germany, the birth rate fell at the same time as the stork population fell.
Is that good?
So. Cause or correlation, right? So, and of course, in that kind of thing, you can then test that by checking other countries and whether there's a similar correlation, right? So this is what science would do, is to test those things. So anyway, so if we look at the way that the Buddha talked about these things, you can see that he actually avoided talking about them in a way that metaphysically implies that a cause is a real thing, right? This goes back to that, yeah? When this is present, this arises, yeah? He doesn't say when this causes that. There's nothing in the way the Buddha expressed things that expresses the idea that a cause is a real thing. He's pointing us to look at what is actually happening. This arises, that arises, yeah? This is an invitation to look into our experience, to understand our mind, and to recognize the patterns that are occurring in our mind. Oh, this happens, that happens. This happens, that happens. Dhiriyupa gives another example. When the sun shines, the temperature rises. Is that a correlation? Who can say? Yeah. And so, yeah, it's a subtle matter. Look, I'm not asking you to believe me when I say there's no such thing as causation, all right? If you want to keep believing in causation, this is fine. When David Hume talked about this, he said, he was like, you know, you can believe everything I say, but I can guarantee you that when you've finished and you get up and you go and make yourself a cup of tea, you will have forgotten about everything and you will go on acting as if cause and everything was real. And you will forget. So I don't want to make like too much of a big point about this, but I'm just drawing attention to the fact that when we observe things changing and we observe our mind, we observe that those shifts in phenomena, this being, that is, this ceasing, that ceases. We're seeing the kaleidoscope of arisings and fallings and passings away in the mind, and we're learning to recognize the patterns that shape how those things are. And so those patterns have a certain regularity to them, right? There's a certain system involved. They're not just arbitrary. And so when we meditate, especially when we meditate, of course, outside of meditation as well, but we learn to recognize those patterns. Sometimes those patterns are very obvious. We walking along the street, we see the cheesecake in the shop, we go, and then we have craving for cheesecake, right? This is very obvious, yeah? And we can see, oh, there's a stimulation and there's a desire and so on and so forth. So these are things that we can observe how dependent origination is being created in the present. And when we go into meditation, we can learn to appreciate those things at an even deeper level. and we can see even more subtly how we are holding on and attaching to some kind of idea of ourself, that we're holding on and attaching to our ego, holding on and attaching to our memories and all of those things, and that our responses to that are creating and shaping who we are and the world we inhabit in the future. So this is a few words for you this evening on the grammar of dependent origination. We've talked about the locative absolute. We've talked about the ablative. We've talked about symmetry and patterns. We've talked about conditionality. And hopefully that has been of interest or of use for some of you and or all of you. And hopefully we didn't lose too many people too much. And I just like if you're sitting there going, oh my God, what is all of this, then don't despair too much, okay? So the next talks will probably be a bit less technical than this one. We'll start to look at some of the actual suttas when the Buddha was talking about dependent origination. So this probably is technical as it gets, okay? But anyway, thanks everybody. And there's a couple of comments here in the comments. I'll get through these. So Adimutta mentions finally getting clarity and depth together about dependent origination and the applied locative absolute. Yes, and the Tim mentions is the paccaya the absolutive? No, the paticca is the absolutive form. Paccaya is the noun form from the same root, pati plus I. Hoti is the hidden verb, right? So we normally would assume that hoti is the hidden verb, although in the abstract formula, it's actually upajati rather than hoti. Although as I said, they have a similar sense in that kind of case. Tessa mentions compression like a JPEG. Yes, arising. So it's like saying arising because of. Yes, that's another way of expressing, right? So we say arising because of something also leans back into something. Yeah. Correlation does not imply causation. It's the mind making assumptions based on past experience. Exactly, right? So we have our perception, right, which we've trained our mind to see things in a certain way, and we expect them to happen in a certain way again. And that's recognizing those patterns is part of wisdom. Like you need to be able to recognize patterns, right? That's how you cope during the day. Somebody, we were talking about this the other day, and somebody mentioned that most of the time, most of the acts that we do, we're not actually deciding things because we're just acting according to habit, and the decisions in the way have already been made. And the reason for that is because deciding things is a hassle, right? It's work. Right? If you imagine that like everything you do in the day, you have to decide, what am I going to do? Or how am I going to get to work? You know, what am I going to eat? Do I drink tea or coffee? You know, do I, all of these things. And then you have to make a decision every day, and it's a hassle. So normally we just act mostly on autopilot, and we reserve our decision making for a few things that matter to us. Okay. So correlation with the causal relation, blah, 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 blah. Precious. Someone says it was precious. That was, thank you. Smeagol. It was nice to see you here. Wonderful. Sorry, I'm just seeing who got that joke. No. Nilakshi got it. Thank you. Thank you, Nilakshi. I feel appreciated. Wonderful. It was very interesting from Kaz. How's it going, Kaz? You good? Dhamma Kippa enjoyed it. Plans on studying Pali in the future. She loves grammar. Look, great. If you can do that, that's fantastic. And look, the thing about Pali grammar, you know, the best piece of advice I got on Pali grammar was from a friend of mine, Ajahn Sangaro, who said, grammar is a paper tiger. Yes. That's a really good piece of advice. Why? Because most of the time you can figure out what it's about without even having to know the grammar. And the grammar is there to help you in those cases where it's not clear what's happening. Yeah. Okay, so Gillian mentions it'd be good to have a whiteboard for talks like this. Yeah, I was thinking about that too. Dagmar says, thanks, Venerable Prasanna. Speaking of artifacting with the lights off, you're kind of a grainy, pixely blob. Oh, thank you, Venerable. That's really kind. Yeah, I appreciate that. Marion says, thanks. Would I say that causation is a word for pattern recognition? I mean, typically in Western philosophy, you would say that those two things are different. So, I'm suggesting that they're closely related. But in Western philosophy and in a lot of business philosophy, would assume that there is a reality, that cause is a real thing, whether you recognize the pattern or not. So when you a lot of scientific testing is to try to, a lot of what you do in scientific testing is try to break the pattern to see how it will break. So you want to see, you want to be able to eliminate false correlations. Yeah. Tessa asks, is learning Pali easier when you speak German already, grammar wise? Tessa, why don't you learn Pali and then let us know? Simple solution. Dhammakipa mentions that she speaks Sanskritized Hindi and some European languages. Will that help me when I learn Pali? Yeah, sure, that'll help you when you learn Pali. And the only thing to just be wary of is that to be wary of false friends, right? So what we call false friends. And that's just to bear in mind that when languages are related, that you often find that words are similar, but they actually might have a different meaning, even though it sounds like it's the same word, right? So you just have to be aware of that, Hindi is a modern language. Hindi is descended from Pali and Sanskrit. It's very similar, but it's 2,500 years later, so words do change their meanings. All right. Thanks for those. Mel.
I have a comment. I've got comments coming up. I was just thinking about the, how you were just saying something about cause, drop away the cause and just think of it as this and this, the correlation.
Right.
It made me think about how we can get there's delusional moha, when you use the Pali, around, there's like a trap, seems very common trap, that we want to get to the bottom of things.
Right.
Explain something,
or right,
we need to know,
right,
and actually, like in meditation or something, well, it's not really the point, is it?
Okay,
like is that, that's what was coming up for me in my brain just then.
That you what,
like if that's what's come up listening to,
yeah, I'm not entirely sure what you're saying. You go on,
I don't know. This you're just telling me that what is it that. But just listening to you then, and what was it? You said something about cause.
I did say something about cause. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That. Yeah. Yeah. And I was just
right,
thinking about it as a correlation.
Right.
Well, I was just thinking about meditation and. I was just thinking about delusion as well around trying to work out the cause of things. We're actually quite we're getting taken down the wrong track.
We can be trapped by what is before our faces. Yeah. By looking at that and thinking we're going to find the answer, I think, Okay, everybody. Oh, yeah, Simran.
You mentioned that whereas ignorance is more like darkness, moha delusion is more actively sort of just
story. Right, right.
So then my question is that from the ignorance as darkness, then how does that sort of lead to a more active delusion that when
right. Right. Yeah. Ignorance has this kind of ignorance is very self-preserving. Yeah. It wants to keep itself in the dark, and it wants to wrap itself in and cloak itself in that unknowing and to keep that absence there. And it generates all of this kind of stuff to try to hide itself. So delusion is the, you know, delusions like the, you can think of delusion as the propaganda arm of ignorance. Right? It's the one that's delusion is the one that makes us all think that we know. So we're not realizing that we in fact don't know. Right? Yeah. Please.
So, ignorance is a requirement for choices.
Correct.
So, when everything is clear, when knowledge is not there, we actually don't see choices. Like, choices are not there.
Okay.
Is that right?
When we don't have ignorance, then we're not making choices, yeah? Is that what you're saying? Yes, that's correct, yeah.
When ignorance is not there.
That's correct, yeah. Clear, yeah. Right? Yeah.
That means choices are not there.
That's right.
Whatever there is, it is.
It is, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Right? Okay.
Just making sure that it is.
That we're on the same page, yeah. Okay, everyone, so we're going to have to wrap up now. So we just about reached the end of the time. Thank you so much, everybody. Thanks so much to the Temple of Humanity for hosting us here and giving us a place to stay, or a place to share the Dhamma with you all. We will be back next week, of course, and we'll also be at Crow's Nest on Wednesday nights. For those of you who are in Sydney, please do come along, and or if you know anybody, got any friends or whatever who are in the area around the North Shore, then let them know that the Wednesday night we're at the Crow's Nest Community Centre every 7 o'clock every Wednesday night. And also on the Sunday, then we have the big event, which has been organised by some of our friends in the Tibet, local Tibetan temple, who are putting on a big event at the town hall. And they said that there's been like 600 or something registrations. So you can go and you can register that. If you're not registered, they say just show up anyway. Whatever, we'll figure something out. And so many of you will know Tina and the good folks at the Metta Center, so they'll be there. And so there'll be lots of activities. So that's a good place to bring your kids or to bring your family. And there'll be some Dhamma talks and discussion, and there'll be a lot of activities. They're having the Shaolin monks will be coming. There'll be a didgeridoo there. There'll be some different kinds of activities and so on. So this is really a kind of a day-long event or celebration of Buddhism in all of its different aspects. So you're most welcome to come and join us for that on the Sunday. Okay? Great. Okay, see you all again. Thank you. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.